From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. On this week's show, we catch up with Royals all-star Frank White to hear about life after the Royals.
I'm not so vain that I won't go out and survive. I mean, because that's what life's all about.
Whooping cough is spreading in Johnson County, and meet a couple who's taken a very traditional route to marriage.
You grow into that relationship rather than jump into it, if you want to call it that.
Plus, the daughter of one of Casey's premier classical pianists takes the stage as a musician in her own right.
Well, after I get back from school, I have to practice probably three, four hours, but if I'm preparing for a competition or a big concert, it's a little more than that.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
Johnson County is in the midst of a whooping cough outbreak. It's not as bad as in Washington State, where they've declared an epidemic of the disease. But Johnson County health workers and schools have been taking extra steps to get a handle on the disease. KCUR's Alana Gordon recently stopped by the health department's Olathe location to find out more about the situation.
Johnson County's vaccine clinics tend to pick up during the summer, especially in August when families come in for required shots before school starts. But the clinic here on 119th Street's already been busy. Samara Sorrell, a nurse with the department, says two Thursdays ago was a big day here.
We saw 103 people and gave over 150 shots.
How many nurses and how many people are there here to do that?
Two of us. That's it.
Yeah, a busy day.
Sorrell says this surge is partly because there's an outbreak of whooping cough in the county, and the health department's advising anyone that has close contact with infants, like new moms, siblings, daycare providers, to get a booster shot for the disease. Nancy Taus, a disease specialist with the county, says she and others are investigating more than 130 reports of whooping cough at this point.
With that many cases come in all at once and continually, then you know something else other than just the norm is happening.
Taus says at first, the cases were concentrated in the southern part of the county.
The ages that we saw at the beginning were 5th grade and 6th grade. Those were the greatest number of cases. And then they started expanding into maybe from 5th grade into the 8th grade.
She got in touch with school nurses, who then identified students that had been in the same room for more than an hour with anyone diagnosed with the disease. The schools then looked up who among those students wasn't already vaccinated for the disease, either for religious or medical reasons.
And those students would need to either be excluded for 21 days or they would need to choose to have a vaccine within 24 hours, and then you could return to school.
Students that had close contact with someone with whooping cough also got antibiotics to prevent symptoms from developing. Taus says the disease is pretty contagious. The most common symptom? A cough.
Especially a younger person, you cough and cough, usually for a period of 2 weeks.
Some infants might just seem lethargic.
But usually, and then maybe an older infant or, a toddler, they cough and cough so hard that they have projectile vomiting. But that is the main thing, is this cough that just lasts and lasts and lasts. Even after someone's been treated, they can cough for another month or 5 weeks afterward. They're not infectious if they've been treated, but they continue to have this persistent cough for weeks.
Whooping cough, also known as pertussis, used to be a leading cause of illness and death among children. That's until a vaccine came out for it in the late 40s. Schools now require the vaccine, but the effectiveness can wane over time. So there's also now a booster shot for older kids and adults. Nowadays, Kansas typically experiences a few whooping cough outbreaks a year, identifying anywhere from 50 to 75 cases of the disease.
It'll go in cycles, pertussis, and there's usually always pertussis out there. So,
but are there always kind of outbreaks like this?
No, not this large. I mean, again, you have cycles where you have large numbers. This is the largest numbers we've had in a while.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it could be a number of reasons. It could be just vaccine issues. Maybe, people aren't immunized. You hit the ones at risk or that's not. It could be circumstances that just hit just right. You've got people that are in confined quarters for a while. you know, it just depends. There's so many things that could cause this.
Nationwide, whooping cough has been creeping back over the last few decades. It was a big problem in California in 2010. Washington State recently declared an epidemic, with nearly 1,500 cases so far this year. Taos and others are hopeful that won't happen in Kansas. One factor working in their favor? Summer break.
We're hoping that with the schools getting out, that will decrease some of that close contact with groups of people. Again, you're going to see probably more cases still coming in because of the exposure time, you know, by the time you've been exposed to the time you're actually having symptoms. Another wave of that for another 2 to 3 weeks, but hopefully then it will be decreased.
And hopefully, she says, doctor's offices and the vaccine clinic here will see more families coming in for booster shots and the other required vaccines for the coming school year. Reporting for Casey Currents, I'm Alana Gordon.
Five-time All-Star Frank White always thought he would finish his baseball career at the Royals. He was the hometown guy who played second base with the team for 18 seasons, starting in 1973. White helped the Royals win the World Series in 1985. His number 20 is one of only three retired by the club. Frank White went on to coach with the Royals and the Red Sox and manage the minor league Wichita Wranglers, and he always hoped to become a Royals manager. He was back with the team working in community relations and broadcasting when the Royals decided not to continue his contract at the end of last year. But now there's a new chapter in Frank White's baseball career. Susan caught up with him to find out more.
The Community America Ballpark sits next to the sprawling Legends Shopping Mall in Wyandotte County. A sign with a red, white, and blue triangle and star announces the home of a minor league team, the Kansas City T-Bones. It's a far cry from the 38,000-seat Kauffman Stadium, but since January, this ballpark has been Frank White's new home. That's when he became the team's first base coach and advisor. Frank's dressed in a burgundy T-bone shirt and cap and appears relaxed and content when we sit down in the clubhouse to talk. He says he doesn't consider this move a step down.
I've been a fry cook, I've been a dishwasher, I've been a busboy, I've been a waiter. I've dug potatoes. I've picked peanuts. I've done a lot of things. So I guess I'm not so high and mighty that I feel like, hey, I can't do this stuff. I shouldn't be doing this stuff. I mean, it's about surviving, and I think that I'm a survivor, and I'm not so vain that I won't go out and survive. I mean, because that's what life's all about.
I know with the very public split from the Royals. You wondered out loud, I read, what went wrong? Because you certainly had been in a number of roles. You were a hometown favorite, et cetera, et cetera. How do you answer that question these days?
Well, I mean, I think I know what went wrong. The question is why it went wrong and why was it such a big deal? And I always feel like when you've been with an organization 15 years and never asked a question, just basically did what they want you to do, and then the first time you don't agree with something, you're fired, then that tells me that maybe there was a plan in place anyway. Even though I wasn't surprised by it, there were some developments leading up to it I wasn't surprised by the move. It's just that it was just one of those situations where I don't think it was very well thought out. And once the decision was made, then there was no backtracking from there.
Now, you've been quoted as saying that everything started going downhill when you applied for a manager position. How so?
Well, I think that from a trust standpoint, when I went to the minor leagues to manage, it was really to get an opportunity to manage the Kansas City Royals baseball team, and I put in a time for it, and I was never interviewed for it. And then the one time I was interviewed, then you bring in a manager that has never managed before, a little insecure having me around. A lot of the coaching staff who didn't have a lot of experience felt the same way. And I just really felt like just the fact that I interviewed for the job, people think I wanted a job. I just think the atmosphere from day one just wasn't one that was conducive to bringing me into the fold and saying, hey, man, this guy is for us, and he's not trying to take my job and that type of stuff. And And that's why I think the interviewing for the job really hurt me here.
Were you shocked and surprised that no one really stood up for you in that whole process?
I was. I mean, when you're working for the club, you don't want people to put their jobs on the line and come out and say, you know, the Royals are, you know, shouldn't make this move. But I thought I should have gotten some private phone calls, you know, where people say, hey, look, you know, sorry this happened, you know, it shouldn't have happened, you know, just some support. And when I didn't get that, it just told me a lot about the people I've been working for all my life, you know, and the people I've been playing with all my life, that maybe they just don't care. You know, it's all about them and all the years that you played and all the good things that you did do.
That must be hard to realize.
When I played baseball, it was because I loved to play the game. I was fortunate enough to play with some great players, and I got support from the players that I hung out mostly with when I played. And I think that when you look at players like we had players who had high integrity. We had players who spoke their mind. We had players who fought for what they thought they needed to fight for. And we didn't sugarcoat too much. And I think that there are certain segment of players who do. And those are the players that usually get ahead most of the time. So, but, you know, I just think that all I wanted to get out of this deal was a fair shake, you know, which I thought I earned. I had two jobs. I was a community relations guy, which was my job. That's the job I thought I was going to retire from. And then when Paul Spitoff got sick, then they asked me to help them on the broadcasting side. And then as he got sicker, I did more games, but I was still doing my job on the other side. And so they said, well, look, you know, he's making money over here, so why don't we cut him over here? But they weren't offering me anything over here. They basically was cutting my salary. So I just didn't think that was right.
So how do you respond to the criticism, I guess, by the Royals saying that you were bad-mouthing them or your color commentary was too negative? How do you respond to that?
Well, somewhat taken aback. I mean, I thought I gave a very honest assessment of the game, of the players. I knew the players personally because I managed a lot of them in the minor leagues. I didn't divulge information about players that I shouldn't have divulged information about. But I think that when you lose a lot of games, and I think there's always a tendency for upper management to take and pretty much play on any word that you say as being negative. And a lot of times when you look at an organization who's lost as much as the Royals have lost over the last 20, 30 years, then sometimes they're the negative ones and not the people that are actually talking about what's going on in the field. Our job is to maintain our integrity and give the people an honest assessment of the game. So if the car is white, you can't tell them it's blue.
Now, some might know that you actually helped construct Royal Stadium. Do you find it ironic that at this point you really have no desire to go back into the stadium?
People say built. That's a big word. You know, I worked there, but I don't think I built anything. You know, I sealed a couple floors and I scraped some mortar and carried some stuff and got through the winter looking for the next baseball season. But I mean, when you're a kid going through that, you don't think about those things. But when I got to the major leagues that following year in June, and you stand out at shortstop, and you're looking up, and you look on the third deck, and you figure that's where you spend most of your time up there. So those things, they're pretty special to you. But you know, when you say, I don't know, when people say you help build, I always have that, man, I don't know anything about building anything, but you know, I don't have any desire to go there, and I just really feel like everything that I've accomplished inside of that stadium, that's always going to be there. Whether they change names or whatever they do, I mean, no matter what they do, it was done. And along with all the other guys who came before me or played with me. So you don't really have to be there to have that feeling. And so if you never played the game and you never stepped on that field and you never been in a big game and you never had it on the line with you at the plate and you never had a chance to make that great defensive play to win your team a game, so all these people can talk about, well, he's not here, he's gone. I mean, but they can't take that away. That's an experience they've never felt before, you know, and I think it's all about how you feel, you know, I feel great about what I've done. I feel great about my accomplishments. I feel great about being here with the T-Bones because all I want to do is live the rest of my life happy. You know, I don't want to deal with – all the paranoid stuff that goes on in Major League Baseball. I don't want to deal with that stuff anymore. I know that I've done a great job. I know from having 1 year junior college, I've managed, I've coached, I've been in the front office, I've been in the community. I was able to make the transition to broadcaster. I have no regrets. I mean, it's full circle, and I have no doubts that I could have managed. But I think that it's just not in the cards, and now it's about taking the rest of your life and doing something positive with it. Because I think in the end, I'm not going to be remembered for what I did on the field. I think I'm going to be remembered what I'm going to do in the community in the next 10 years.
Is there any situation that you can imagine that would ever get you back in the stadium?
New ownership.
You're listening to Casey Currents. We're talking with Frank White of the Kansas City T-Bones. Do you think that the way you were treated by the Royals had a bad impact on the African-American fan base, many of whom, I mean, I can't quote everybody, but kind of felt like that their guy was given a raw deal?
Well, I mean, the amount of attention that a major league organization doesn't pay to a certain segment of the city is always going to draw some sort of negative response when if that person who's out there in front that they recognize is fired or mistreated or whatever, and they're going to say, well, what has the Royals done for the community? What have they done for the black community or the minority community? I think those questions are just normal questions that come around. Everybody starts counting things up, and what have they done? And if it's not much, then that's where the negative response is going to come from. Where I was a guy that was always visible, always in the community, always doing things in the community. They knew me. They knew what I stood for. They knew that I had integrity. And I think that's kind of where that comes from. And being from here, I think people tend to take it a little more personal.
What do you think it will take to get African-Americans back involved in the game again?
You know, that's probably a $1 million question. I think that baseball turned away from drafting a lot of African-American players. When you go back to when I was, most of the guys that I was involved with, we weren't drafted players. We signed through tryout camps. And I think that in the old days, before the Latin America became as popular as it is, Asian countries became as popular as they are, most of the black baseball players are raw, what they consider raw. So it may take you a lot longer to get to where you need to go, but your athletic ability is strong. So I think that baseball, in this instant gratification way sometimes, they want to go the route of how quick can we get them there. But they do have some things in place, like the RBI programs in Kansas City, Kansas, and in Missouri. You have the Urban Youth Academy in California. They're building a new one in New Orleans. So there's some things that Major League Baseball is putting in place to get more minority and African-American players playing the game. So we hope that in the future, maybe 10 years from now, things will change a little bit.
What do you think that you bring to the T-Bones right now that they need? What are you working on with your players?
Well, I don't know if they need anything, but you know, they've been very successful here, and as an organization, I think that you know, you hope you bring credibility. You hope you bring a touch of class with you when you come to another organization. The players, you basically want to be normal. You know, you don't want to go in there saying, I did this, I did that. You know, basically you let them do what they do, and you try to pick certain things that you think you can help them be better at. And I think that's what they like most, is just because all the guys here, you know, they're trying to get back to the next level. And there's something in their game that's holding them back. And so basically you just watch them on their offense, their defense, their base running, and then you just give them little subtle hints about try this, try that, and they go out and try it. If it works, they'll hold on to it. If it won't, they'll let it go. So it's just paying attention and just show them that you care.
Well, Frank, thank you for being with us on Casey Currents and taking time out of your day.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Frank White is currently first base coach for the Kansas City T-Bones.
We did contact the Royals for their version of Frank White's departure. They're not commenting on the situation. Coming up, meet a local couple who met each other via a family arrangement. You're listening to Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Last month, Susan interviewed Kansas City, Missouri's 3rd District Councilman Jermaine Reed. At age 27, he's one of the city's youngest ever council members and represents what's arguably one of the city's most challenging districts. The 3rd District includes neighborhoods in the city's central east side, including the Old Northeast. These neighborhoods have some of the highest rates of poverty and crime in the metro area. Susan asked Jermaine Reed about some of these challenges in her interview and about talk of a recall campaign against him. That effort has died down, but just a few weeks ago, another recall drive against Reed came up. That group actually filed an affidavit and has begun collecting signatures. We thought we'd follow up on our interview by checking in with the person leading the recall effort, Amina Powell.
I really didn't want it to come to that, but Jermaine's approach to kind of managing the people that live there, he left us no alternative.
Powell's main complaint about Councilman Reed's leadership has to do with his support of a new police campus on 27th and Prospect, which should begin construction in the next year. The 4-block complex will house the East Patrol Division and the crime lab. But first, more than 100 houses will need to be removed to make way for the project. According to the Kansas City Star, about 60 are occupied and 33 of them owner-occupied. Amina Powell says the city picked an area that has a lot of homeowner investment.
I mean, we're talking about ripping out a neighborhood in a historic district, number one. The Wendell Phillips neighborhood ties into the 18th and Vine district, and that's where a lot of the old musicians and artists actually lived in our neighborhood.
She says she recognizes that the rest of the council supported this project, including 3rd District at-large Councilwoman Melba Curls.
Yeah, okay, so if the rest of the city thinks that that's, you know, great, at least have somebody there championing the interests of the neighborhoods and the communities.
Councilman Jermaine Reed says that he helped negotiate better compensation for those who will lose their homes, up to 150% of the highest appraised value. But he also says that the $57 million project will be a catalyst for revitalization along Prospect. Reed says that citizens have every right to gather signatures for his recall, but he's focused on other things.
I have to remain completely focused on serving the constituents of the 3rd District, and I was duly elected and will continue to work extremely hard, as I have been, on behalf of the 78,000 residents of the 3rd District and the 500,000 residents here in Kansas City, Missouri.
The petitioners have until June 8th to gather 1,633 signatures to take Jermaine Reed's recall to 3rd District voters in August.
Spring is in full bloom in Kansas City, and that means it's wedding season. For most couples in the U.S., the story is pretty similar. Two people meet and start dating. Then they get more serious and become a couple, and after a year or a few years, they get engaged. But in many cultures, Asian, African, and traditional European, marriages are typically arranged by parents. As Kansas City has become increasingly international, we've become home to many couples in arranged marriages, and some of them are even arranged here. Alex Smith has a story of one arranged marriage in Kansas City's Hindu community.
About 12 years ago, Ashish Yadav decided he was ready to get married. He was 23, had studied computer and electrical engineering in college, and was working as a software programmer. Ashish had moved to the United States from New Delhi with his family when he was a teenager, and his life was not too different from most Americans. But when it came to finding a bride, Ashish's plan was pretty far from the American romantic ideal. Ashish wanted his parents to help him by setting up an arranged marriage.
Well, I've been open to that because my belief, I mean, as our culture is, you know, the parents, of course, know what's good for you and what it's, you listen to their advice and guidance. You may or may not agree all the time. That's, you know, common.
His search began the way a lot of arranged marriage searches begin these days, on the internet. He registered on Shadi.com, the world's largest matrimonial website. They claim to have introduced over 1 million married couples. Shoddy.com looks pretty much the same as any dating website. And as Vandana Yadav explains, customers use these matrimonial websites about the same way.
Basically, first the look. You look at the picture, right? If you like it or not, that only you want to read the profile later. So if you like the picture, you read the profile and everything. And you see the job and education and qualification and the background, you know. So you read everything and then you think if you like it, then you need to proceed further.
But along with the modern internet technology, arranged marriages still rely on a lot of ancient methods too. As long as there have been arranged marriages, there have been matchmakers. Matchmakers have traditionally been older relatives or even professionals, but in Vandana's case, it was her younger brother. Vandana was 22 years old, living with her family just outside of New Delhi, when her younger brother started cruising Shoddy.com to find a husband for her. The brother discovered Ashish's profile and decided to visit him while on a business trip in the United States. When he returned to India, Vandana's brother reported good things about Ashish.
Yeah, he said it's a nice family. They are like just like us. They just cook Indian food. They're vegetarian. And it's a nice boy, very well raised. They don't drink, smoke, anything. Very good boys. They're very good educated. They have a good job. So why don't you go for it? I mean, he said, even in India, you can't get a boy like that. I mean, with no, you know, drinking, smoking. If nobody does that, it's a good thing, you know, not a spoiled one.
At this point, both Ashish and Vandana got approval from their parents to get acquainted to find out if they liked each other. So they started talking on the phone, long distance from Kansas City to New Delhi. They talked every day for half an hour to an hour, and after a month, they decided they would meet and have an engagement ceremony. For a lot of Americans, a month-long courtship over the phone would barely scratch the surface in deciding on a life partner. But Ashish says that was all they needed.
We were good friends by the time we decided to meet. It wasn't something that was awkward or some, you know, that you felt uncomfortable. We were so...
There's a little bit of the shyness.
But even if you spend 2 years, you really, you know, can't be sure about anything and everything.
Yeah.
So, yeah, to say 1 month is short or too much, it's just a matter of do you feel comfortable with the other person. And I felt I did. I was comfortable. So then that's why we proceeded.
About 8 months later, they were married at the Hindu temple in Lenexa. The Yadavs' arranged marriage was different from their parents or grandparents in more ways than just the internet. In the past few decades, thousands of years of arranged marriage tradition have changed pretty dramatically. In the United States and India, dowry payments have usually been replaced by informal gifts between families. Even more important is the role children are now given in the decision-making process.
In the past, you would say it was just mostly the elders deciding, okay, this is it, you know, and you're done. Mm-hmm. Now it's more involvement with the whole family and the individual who's getting married involved.
Yeah,
it's more common, you know, input is taken from everyone before making a decision.
Supporters of arranged marriage point to how the divorce rate among these couples is just about 4-6% compared to the 50% divorce rate in the United States. Part of this is likely due to the stigma placed on divorce by many traditional cultures or the complex divorce laws in countries like India, but many psychologists think there's more going on. Dr. Richard Zeitner specializes in marriage counseling, and he teaches marriage counseling techniques to fellow psychologists. Zeitner says Westerners, with their storybook romance culture, often set themselves up for disappointment when they get married.
Most people go into marriages, again, we're talking about Western marriages, with a tremendous amount of expectation about the way it's going to be. It's usually idealized. It is usually romanticized, and the expectations are typically not met. When certain obstacles are encountered that are not negotiated, that's when often a therapist is summoned.
Zeitner says couples in arranged marriages don't have nearly the lofty expectations of Western couples, and because of that, they avoid a lot of disappointment. People in these marriages also view their roles differently from the couples he sees in his office.
Most couples come, obviously, with dissatisfaction of the other. There is either a conscious or unconscious wish for the other one to change and less tendency to want to change oneself. The interesting thing about arranged marriages is that the expectations for the marriage are very different. accommodation to the other takes precedence over wanting the other one to somehow accommodate to you. I think this makes for a very different infrastructure of the relationship right from the very beginning, because the focus is on making family life, making the relationship work, as opposed to getting one's own personal needs met.
Western psychologists are just beginning to understand arranged marriages. In his nearly 30 years of private practice, Dr. Zeitner has seen just two couples in arranged marriages, and there have only been a handful of studies about these marriages. But the Yadav seem to agree with psychology's basic understanding of arranged marriages versus what Indians call a love marriage.
Well, I would say that, you know, in a love marriage, you already have your mindset that, well, I'm in love, so everything's happy dandy, everything's going to work out. Mm-hmm. And in arranged marriage, you get to know the person and then fall in love with them, and then it's a little bit different.
You try hard.
Yeah, you grow into that relationship rather than jump into it, if you want to call it that.
Doesn't mean so. Yeah, that's what I'll say, yeah. I mean, you work harder to keep that relationship going in arranged marriage. Both the partners, I'm just want to say that.
Today, Ashish and Vandana Yadav are in their mid-30s, and they have a house in Overland Park. The Yadavs have now been married about 10 years, and they have two little girls.
While arranged marriage is still the norm among most Indians, others are abandoning the practice to find their own partners. Next week, Alex Smith brings us a story of one woman who did just that. If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
The organization American Rivers is out with its annual report on what it considers the most endangered rivers in the country. Coming in at number 10 on the list is the Kansas River. Kansas Public Radio's health reporter, Brian Thompson, looked into what endangered really means.
Laura Caldwell is the person who recommended that the Kansas River be put on the endangered rivers list. Caldwell is the Kansas River Keeper. She's hired by the nonprofit conservation group Friends of the Kaw to advocate for the Kansas River, also known as the Kaw. Caldwell says the most endangered status does not imply that the Kaw is one of the country's most polluted rivers.
No, it does not. It means that there are decisions being made that are going to affect the future of the river. And in this case, it's the dredging, the expanded dredging.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is considering a proposal from five private dredging companies to reopen some now closed dredging sites on the Kaw. Caldwell says the plan would also allow the companies to take an additional 1 million tons of sand and gravel from the riverbed each year, an increase of almost 50%.
Right now, we are in North Lawrence, and we're looking across the river to dredge. It is not working right now.
A video on the Friends of the Kaw website demonstrates what river dredging sounds like.
It looks like a pontoon boat, but if you get up close to it, you'll see probably this 12-foot long, it looks like a chainsaw blade. And they lower that into the river and actually auger sand, gravel, and water out of the river. And it's sucked up onto the bank processing area in a big black hose. And when it gets up there, they separate the sand and the gravel and the water.
Caldwell says this process creates a deep hole in the riverbed.
The river wants to fill that hole. That's its natural process. And it pulls silt, sand, gravel, whatever it can to fill that hole.
Caldwell says as a result, trees and plants collapse into the water upstream, damaging the native habitat. And Caldwell says the riverbed is polluted with various toxins from industrial waste discharged into the river for decades. She says those chemicals pose less of a threat when they lie on the river bottom undisturbed.
The dredge actually churns up the water, and it churns up old contaminants like PCBs, heavy metals, sediment, and that pollutes the water column. And so it's more expensive to treat that water, and over 600,000 people depend on the Kansas River for drinking water.
Caldwell's claims are challenged by dredgers. Mike O'Dell of Holiday Sand and Gravel in the Kansas City suburb of Shawnee has been in the dredging business for almost 40 years. He concedes it's possible that dredging might churn up toxins from the riverbed, but Odell says it's never showed up in water tests.
We had the same concerns on the Missouri River when we dredged there, and we did quite a bit of water quality testing before we could dredge near the water intakes, and we just never picked up anything.
Odell says public water supplies monitor for pollutants all the time, and they've never reported any problems with contaminants stirred up by dredging. A call to the Lawrence Water Treatment Plant at least partly bears that out. A spokeswoman there says they've never noticed such problems, although that's something they've never tried to correlate. Mike Tate heads the Bureau of Water at the Kansas Department of Health and Environment. He says KDHE has never done any sampling of water quality around dredges, but Tate sees no reason to be concerned.
To the best of our knowledge, no. There have been previous work done on this by a gentleman from KU, Frank Cross, and believe that his studies show really no discernible increase between upstream and downstream concentrations.
However, Professor Cross retired in 1991 and died in 2001, so those studies may be outdated. Teresa Rasmussen of the U.S. Geological Survey's Kansas Water Science Center says dredging does resuspend fine sediment. When contaminants are attached to that sediment, she says those contaminants would be resuspended too. That's based on reservoir studies. Rasmussen says the agency has not studied those effects in the Kansas River. As to the concerns about upstream erosion, dredger Mike Odell says the Corps of Engineers shuts down any dredge that lowers the riverbed by more than 2 feet. He thinks there's no reason to be concerned about those operating in stable areas of the river.
There's such little sand being removed from the Kansas River now that, it's not a big issue.
Melinda Daniels disagrees. She's a Kansas State University professor who specializes in how rivers function and change over time. Daniel says it's true that dredge holes fill back in over time, but
the problem is that sand that they're filling in with is coming from somebody's bank upstream. It's not just coming from nowhere. We know the physics of how rivers function. If you dig a hole in the bed of a river, it causes erosion upstream. I mean, that's an unequivocal fact.
Daniels says the Kansas River is currently much more stable than it used to be, thanks to the dredging limits imposed by the Corps of Engineers. She says the expansion of dredging the Corps is now considering would return the river to the levels of erosion that caused problems 30 years ago.
Bridge footings were being threatened, water intakes. Farmers were losing their fields at too rapid a rate. It was really unacceptable.
The Corps of Engineers plans to hold a public hearing later this year on the dredging proposal. Their decision is expected sometime around the end of 2012. For the Kansas Public Radio Network, I'm Brian Thompson.
After the break, a teenage violinist has her debut with the Kansas City Symphony. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, new Missouri congressional districts survived a court challenge, a plan for improving Kansas City infrastructure headed for the ballot, and Governor Brownback signed off on a huge Kansas tax cut. Steve Bell recaps those and other top stories of the week on the KCUR Weekend News Review.
Governor Sam Brownback promptly signed a Kansas bill that will cut personal income taxes and eliminate them altogether for nearly 200,000 businesses.
Today's legislation will create tens of thousands of new jobs and help to make Kansas the best place in America to start and grow a small business.
Moderate Republicans like Senate President Steve Morris felt betrayed. Democrats like Lawrence's Paul Davis predicted state deficits in the billions in just a few years.
Schools having to make huge cuts. They're going to have to lay off teachers. Class sizes are going to grow. You're going to see longer waiting lists for the disabled.
But conservative Republicans like Johnson County Representative Marvin Klebb said those forecasts don't take into account the economic growth that the state will get from cutting income taxes.
More business growth will create more jobs, which will create more income tax withholdings and everything, more sales taxes.
The legislature wrapped up its session, but without completing any of its redistricting chores, leaving that to the courts. Across the state line, the Missouri Supreme Court upheld that state's congressional redistricting maps, though one judge dissented, saying there was evidence of gerrymandering in eastern Jackson County. a double ballot issue to help with street repairs, parks, and a federally mandated sewer update sailed through the Kansas City City Council. It would eliminate several existing taxes and add a half cent to the sales tax. Mayor Sly James said it's not, as some fear, too complicated to win voter approval.
I happen to think that the people in Kansas City are a little smarter than that.
Yeah, I agree.
And they can read and they can figure it out.
The companion ballot issue is $500 million in bonds to finance the sewer improvements. The council also updated Kansas City's anti-prowler ordinance to make it more effective in addressing the problems of would-be robbers casing homes and businesses. Councilman Scott Wagner explained the need.
To deal with homes and buildings and structures under any circumstance, inhabited, uninhabited, but habitable.
The votes were not in yet in a mail-in ballot on creation of a downtown streetcar zone, but the city clerk reports that only about 600 out of the 5,400 eligible voters asked for ballots before the deadline. President Obama was in Joplin to speak at the Joplin High School graduation on the eve of the one-year anniversary of that city's EF5 tornado.
Even though I expect that some of you will ultimately end up leaving Joplin, I'm pretty confident that Joplin will never leave you. The people who went through this with you, the people who you once thought of as simply neighbors or acquaintances, classmates, the people in this auditorium tonight, your family now. They're your family.
The aftermath of the tornado was far from over. The latest concerns are about scattered dust from lead-contaminated gravel left over from Joplin's long-ago lead mining days. Wrapping up the week, a Chinese company named Wanda bought Kansas City-based AMC Entertainment, creating the world's largest movie theater company, and the pace picked up and lines shortened a bit at Johnson County Motor Vehicle Licensing Offices, where a new state computer system has caused long waits and multiple visits for 3 weeks. This is KCUR.
Because of a pinched nerve in his wrist, Kansas City's Tom Watson is sitting out this week's Senior PGA Championship in Michigan, a tournament he won a year ago. Watson is already a member of the World Golf Hall of Fame. He's one of those ageless wonders becoming more and more common in professional sports today. As KCUR's Greg Eklund reports, chances are you'll hear more about Watson and other athletes succeeding in their twilight years.
At the age of 59, 3 years ago, Tom Watson nearly won his sixth British Open. Only Stuart Sink, who was born a year before Watson captured his first PGA Tour event, stood in the way. After four rounds, they were tied, but Watson lost in a playoff.
You know, it was a hell of a week. It really would have been a heck of a story, wouldn't it?
But last year's victory at the Senior PGA Championship marked Watson's 14th career major and his sixth since turning 50.
And it's my privilege, on behalf of 27,000 men and women professionals of the PGA of America, to present you with the Alfred S. Bourne Trophy.
Well done.
Thank you.
Pretty good for an old geezer.
That's right.
Man, I remember this thing was heavy.
Watson's 62 now. Once his wrist is healed up, two of his five scheduled tournaments this summer are pitted against the PGA Tour regulars, 20 or 30 years younger than him. That head-to-head competition against the Tour's youth doesn't happen by magic.
Sports Rehab, this is Jessica. How can I help you?
Paul McGannon, the founder of Sports Rehabilitation and Therapy in Overland Park, has worked with Tom Watson. He wouldn't be surprised to see Tom Watson win again.
I mean, I think it's definitely achievable.
McGannon attributes another potential victory to Watson's drive and willingness to remain in top physical condition.
We're seeing life expectancy getting on up into your 80s now. So I think as long as he or anyone continues to be dedicated and focused, both mentally, that the physical part follows and there's no end to it.
Though he's sidelined from this week's Senior PGA Championship, it hasn't stopped Watson from working out.
I work on stretching, aerobics, leg strengthening, flexibility. There's a variety of things, abs, midsection, that's something you have to do at my age, I tell you.
Watson has become wiser as the years of competitive golf have piled up. It's the same reason, Paul McGannon says, that 49-year-old Jamie Moyer, a pitcher for the Colorado Rockies, is winning.
No question about it. I mean, that's what gives those individuals a competitive edge, because they've put at the highest level of priority their physical well-being and their mental well-being. And the first step to physical well-being is getting your mental well-being on the right page and just saying, I have to do this.
Watson competed at the Masters last month as the oldest player in the field. The PGA Champions Tour, for those 50 and older, enables Watson and others in his age bracket to stay on top of their game. Because of that, Watson believes someone from the elder set will win a major against the best who are 20 or 30 years younger.
There's always that probability. There's not a question. There's a probability that's going to happen.
And Watson isn't ruling himself out. Greg Eklund, KCUR News, Benton Harbor, Michigan.
A teenager took the stage on Friday night with the Kansas City Symphony at Hillsburg Hall at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts, and she was right out front. As KCUR's Laura Spencer reports, the winner of the symphony's Young Artist Competition, Maria Udenich, is a musician who was born to play classical music.
It's early evening at the Graham Tyler Memorial Chapel, a 1930s gray stone church on a slope of the Park University campus. In the basement, two students speak quickly in Russian, walking past a row of practice studios. Stanislav Udenich's office door is open. There are two pianos side by side. A native of Uzbekistan, dark-haired and animated, Udenich is the artistic director of Park's International Center for Music.
We are able to create a very personal, sort of family-like conservatory, boutique conservatory, as we say.
In 2001, Udenich was a gold medal winner at the Van Cliburn International Piano Competition in Fort Worth, Texas. It's considered the world's most prestigious competition for classical piano. After a worldwide tour and recording, since 2003, he's been building a growing music program at Park. Next door, the office of Ben Sayevich. He's on the faculty and Maria Udenich's violin teacher. That's right, Stanislav's daughter.
What is she like as a student? Well, very challenging, very independent, and wonderfully creative.
For Sayevich, who studied with teachers in Lithuania, Israel, and the United States, the student-teacher relationship is a partnership.
You make decisions together about phrasings, about technical elements of playing that comes with the territory of such a complicated instrument as the violin.
Maria Udenich was born in Russia and started playing the violin at the age of three after her family moved to the United States. She doesn't look at the music on the stand for Khachaturian's concerto for violin and orchestra. She says it's all in her head.
Well, everything, yes, I have to keep working on, and it's also a lot of emotional input to that piece.
At 16, this year marked Maria's first year of competition. In February, she won the Kansas City Symphony's Young Artist Competition and a chance to perform the concerto on stage with the orchestra. In March, she placed second in an international competition in Washington, D.C. Her teacher, Ben Sayevich, says competing can be tough psychologically, but it can help a musician create a thick skin. On a quiet, leafy street in South Overland Park, Maria's mother, Tatiana Udenich, with large brown eyes and flowing brown hair, is finishing up a piano lesson with a young student. Tatiana started taking music lessons at the age of six in the Soviet Union. She met her husband, Stanislav, at the Tashkent Conservatory in Uzbekistan.
Of course, classical is our work, and this is the most profound and limitless, I would say, in all aspects, in the depth of ideas, in feelings, in emotions.
Dressed in jeans and a t-shirt with her long brown hair tight in a braid, Maria settles into a couch in their performance room. She's in 10th grade at Barstow and talks about her schedule.
Well, after I get back from school, I have to practice probably three, four hours. But if I'm preparing for a competition or a big concert, it's a little more than that.
With the Kansas City Symphony performance coming up, on this night she's poised to head back to Park for another practice.
It's pretty hard to balance. Sometimes you have to make sacrifices.
It's a busy life, and I really love it.
Maria's father, Stanislav, grew up with a father who was a violinist. His mother and grandmother were pianists, all teachers. He says the recent competitions have given Maria a sense of achievement, and he's seen her mature and become more determined.
I know how complicated it is, how much sacrifices one needs to give for the career. You know, if you ask me where I see her in the future, I would say that I see her on stage.
It's a day before a performance at Helsburgh Hall at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. Maria Yudenich stands near music director Michael Stern, and the musicians welcome her to the stage for her first rehearsal. In the audience, Maria's mother, Tatiana, sits a few rows back. A few rows behind her, her teacher, Ben Sayevich, stands. He holds the music score ready to take notes. And in the next section back, Maria's father, Stanislav. Stanislav Yudenich says a friend once told him that to hear Yudenich play feeds his soul. He says that's what musicians do, they give. And he says even if Maria decides not to pursue music as a career, it will always be a part of her. Laura Spencer, KCUR News.
For a photo slideshow of Maria Yudenich and her musical community, check our website at kcur.org and click on Arts and Culture.
Casey Kearns is produced by Sylvia with assistant producers Alex Smith and Suzanne Hogan. Carrie Coogan is our intern, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.